Welcome to episode 10 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. I'm joined today by Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and is now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. And a little later in the program, we're going to be joined by Mark Weatherford, a principal in the Chertoff Group, but also the principal cybersecurity official at DHS until about a year ago. We'll be talking about how DHS is doing in the effort to improve the nation's cybersecurity. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS, and currently holding the record for returning to Steptoe and Johnson the most number of times to practice law. So let's get started. As has become traditional, we'll begin with this week in NSA and Snowden news. A couple of things that are interesting that are worth discussing. The director of NSA, Keith Alexander, he's getting very short in tenure, and he's hinted in a Wall Street Journal article talking about his testimony that maybe the government doesn't have to collect all of this metadata to ensure that the program operates properly. Not exactly clear what he was saying in that context, but it's a breach in the wall that the government has shown up to now, saying we have to collect this data because the phone companies don't keep it long enough and because it's too hard to search if you don't pursue the if you don't collect the information and put it in one place. The idea that the government might pursue this while the data is in the hands of the companies or perhaps a third party, using standard national security or other subpoenas, is a big change. It would completely change the nature of the program and probably would have ensured that there was no controversy at all about this prior to the Snowden disclosures. Now NSA is so deep in a hole, I'm not sure this completely gets it out of it. And it's not clear that this is going to happen, but it does seem clear that NSA is looking at dramatic changes as part of its options. You know, Jason, you've been there. When you're taking enough fire as a government agency, sooner or later you start changing policies you never thought you were going
to
give up.
That's exactly right. Although this was a surprise that they were willing to change this one, since part of the rationale for the program was that they needed to collect the entire haystack to find the needle. So the suggestion that they could accomplish their objectives by collecting only portions of the haystack, I think, was a little further than I thought they would go.
But it turns out that according to some of the leaks, they're probably only getting 25% of the haystack now, because of difficulties collecting mobile data that is limited to the data that they have promised the court they would collect. So, it may be that this program is, ripe for reorganization in any event. Well, we'll see. It is a possibility. The other thing that, I thought was mildly interesting was that the government filed a request with the FISA court saying we'd like to keep this data for more than 5 years, even though we promised to keep it only 5 years. And the reason they gave for that is that there's litigation everywhere by a bunch of people alleging that they have been the subject of collection. And I think the government wanted to make sure that it was not accused of spoliation of evidence by dropping the data off the back of the truck. And I suppose that's realistic. If this were a white-collar criminal investigation, we'd be telling people, don't destroy anything.
Right, that's right.
Yeah,
so it's certainly a creative way to get the court to authorize the government to hold it for longer than 5 years.
Well, it didn't work.
Right.
and the court said no, 5 years is all. That was partly because some of the litigants, at least the ACLU, said we're litigating to get you to get rid of all of it, not to keep it longer. We don't want it kept longer. And if you're, if you're thinking about this strategically, it may be that the whole thing was a bit of theater designed to get exactly that concession from the other parties. Right. Now they can't come in 2 years and say, well, there may be no evidence now, but what about everything they destroyed? This was a plot to get rid of the evidence that we've been wiretapped. Now they can't say that.
That's right. That's right. And if that was the gambit that was well played.
Yes, yes. And I can't think of any other reason to do it. I think they were just being extra cautious. Okay, that is This Week in NSA, relatively short. But we'll make up for it by This Week in Bitcoin. Bitcoin has produced now suicides, bankruptcies, street theater, allegations, you know, drive-by ambush interviews, and that's all without talking about the substance of the currency. What is going on here, Jason?
Well, it's been a dizzying week of news in Bitcoin. It's really the stuff of Hollywood. In fact, I don't know how many aspiring screenwriters are in our audience, but if there are any, they should be paying attention to what's going on in Bitcoin this week, because I'm not sure even Hollywood can make this up. The news started with the collapse of Mt. Gox, which at one point last year was the largest Bitcoin exchange in the world. It was handling some 80% of the world's Bitcoin exchanges. In early February, Mt. Gox suspended trading or withdrawals for a few days because it discovered what it said was a bug in the Bitcoin software that made it possible for users to conduct fraudulent transactions. And some other exchanges with less cool names and less well-known exchanges discovered the same thing and put a patch in place to fix it. Mt. Gox never quite seemed to recover from that bad news, because the news got even worse in late February. They announced that they had been a apparent victim of a hack, and that about 850,000 bitcoins, about 750,000 of which belonged to their customers, which at the time was roughly 7% of the universe of issued bitcoins, had disappeared.
And that must be, I haven't run the math, but that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. I mean, you know, the valuation changes daily, but at that time it was valued at about $450 to $500 million. Right. It was a lot of money. And then on February 28th, perhaps the result of this double whammy of bad publicity, announced that they were going bankrupt. They announced actually that beginning last night they would be opening a call center so customers could call in and ask them questions about what was going on. I don't imagine customers had more than one question, which is, where the hell is my money?
And the answer is going to be, we don't know.
We don't know.
Or either that or, whoa!
But Mt. Gox wasn't the only exchange to go under in the last 10 days or so. There was an exchange called Flexcoin in Vancouver that also went under, also the apparent victim of hacking. And no word on the scope of the loss of bitcoins and what's happened to those. You mentioned the suicide. This is actually a very sad story. A young woman who was the CEO of yet another Bitcoin exchange, this one based in Singapore called First Meta, she was only 28 years old, was found dead last week. And it was an apparent suicide, although the authorities are still investigating. And if you read the reports about it on the web, or I should say the commentary to the news reports about it on the web, there are conspiracy theories abound that attempt to connect this to, first of all, suggest it's not a suicide, and then attempted to connect it to Mt. Gox.
Well, I have a blog, and I occasionally read the comments on my posts, and so I wouldn't spend a lot of time reading the comments on other people's stories, given the quality of the comments that I got on mine.
Well, you know, that's good advice for anybody who writes or ever writes anything online. Although I read it more out of curiosity until I got to the one that actually blamed it on Obamacare. And then the Japanese government last week announced that it was not going to treat Bitcoin as a currency. It would subject it to sales tax and other taxes, but that it would prohibit its financial institutions from issuing Bitcoin as a currency, which is echoed a pronouncement China made last year, that it would not allow its banks to engage in Bitcoin transactions. And within 48 hours of China making that announcement, the value of Bitcoin dropped by about 50%. So that's the biggest substantive blow to Bitcoin, is that a major economy is not going to allow it to be treated as a currency. And then the street theater you mentioned, which is by itself would be the biggest story in any week involving Bitcoin. Newsweek published a cover story late last week saying it had identified the man who created Bitcoin.
who called himself, what was the?
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Right. So he was publicly calling himself that. And it turns out, drum roll, that, Newsweek thinks that the man who has that, pseudonym is?
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Yeah, okay, hiding in plain sight, huh?
No, so for years and years and years, since Bitcoin was created, all anyone knew was that the creator used that name, but no one knew if it was an actual person. Some people thought it was an acronym, some people thought it was the alias for a teenager in Japan, and some believed it was a James Bond villain who was secretly plotting to collapse the world's financial system. And a Newsweek reporter named Leah McGrath Goodman did some homework and, pursued the theory that it was actually a human being named Satoshi Nakamoto, and she found one. Who by age and work experience seems to at least have the life experience and the skills that would perhaps allow him to have created Bitcoin. The 64-year-old guy lives in Los Angeles area with his mother, used to do some work for, various military agencies as a government contractor, as a background in math and physics and the sciences, and who was born with the name Satoshi Nakamoto, but later, made that his middle name and gave himself the first name of Dorian. Supposedly because he wanted to sound more Western. He denied vigorously, including in an exclusive interview with the AP, that he had anything to do with Bitcoin. He chose the AP to do the interview because they promised to buy him lunch. He said he would talk to one reporter who would agree to feed him. He claims that he first heard of Bitcoin 3 weeks ago when his son told him that there was a Newsweek reporter trying to reach him. And in fact, at one point in the AP interview, he referred to it as Bitcom, which was either a legitimate denial or, you know, sneaky brilliant. You know, I'm not sure what you would expect from someone who stayed under the radar for this long, that, you know, I don't think anyone should reasonably expect him to have embraced the fact that he had been publicly outed. So the fact that the person they believe is Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin, denies being the creator of Bitcoin is not itself a surprise. The biggest issue in the story is he made comments to the reporter, the Newsweek reporter, in the presence of two police officers to the effect that I am no longer involved in that and I cannot discuss it. And the reporter says that was a clear reference to Bitcoin. He says that it's taken out of context and that what he meant was that he's not involved in engineering anymore. Having not been there and just read his account and hers, I would suggest hers sounds a little bit more plausible. But, as I said, one would not expect the person who created Bitcoin and stayed out of the public eye for this long to, enjoy being outed. And as I said, he's got the skill set to have done this. And even his own family members said that they would have no trouble believing he could have done it, although they couldn't say one way or another.
Although, you know, how foolish would it be to use the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto in this context? It seems a little implausible, but he hasn't had a job since like 2004, right?
Right, and lives fairly modestly, despite reportedly having about $400 million in Bitcoin at his disposal.
Well, maybe he had him at Mt. Gox too, so.
For his sake, I hope not.
All right. Any sense about the legal consequences of all of this? It strikes me that, none of it directly affects, the U.S. stance on, Bitcoin. Although, boy, is it a lesson that, it's harder than, most geeks think to just invent a currency.
Well, that's for sure. I mean, I think that, you know, there was already, FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, had already issued regulations or guidance last March, almost exactly a year ago, explaining that Bitcoin exchanges would be regulated as money services businesses and be subject to the Bank Secrecy Act and all the anti-money laundering regulations that apply to Western Union and MoneyGram and more traditional, money services businesses. And the state of New York has, I think, is in the lead, although there are other states involved too, that are exploring state regulation for Bitcoin exchanges. I think that there probably has been a greater momentum given to those efforts as a result of all this, you know. But Bitcoin marches on. I mean, the same last week or the week before, in the wake of Mt. Gox collapsing, there was a senator calling for a ban on Bitcoins in the United States. And the same week, there were Bitcoin ATMs arriving in various U.S. cities. So it's not going away, and its value rebounded quickly, although not completely after the Bitcoin, after the Mt. Gox collapse. But I think that there'll be even greater incentive for federal and state regulators to to monitor these exchanges. And some people believe that stronger exchanges and more stable exchanges will come out of all of this.
Well, let's bring our special guest into the conversation. Mark, what do you think is going to happen?
I just wanted to add into the security theater, or the theater there a little bit. I think it was last week, someone got stopped going through, by TSA going through an airport because he had referenced Bitcoin, so they wanted to search his bag for his Bitcoins because they thought he might be carrying illegally more than $10,000 worth of Bitcoins through.
Boy, I say, well, I think you could say you can look at my wallet all you like, and this it becomes impossible for CBP to do the $10,000 checks because all you have to do is some form of low grade encryption on USB thumb drive and you're done. So this is going to turn out to be a money laundering nightmare.
Well, maybe you'll have people, to the extent people have their Bitcoin wallets on their smartphones, you'll have CBP doing warrantless searches of their smartphones.
Well, of course, we know those are all perfectly legal, right. In most places at least. But they're going to be defeated by encryption,
yeah,
I believe.
That's right.
It will be fascinating to watch. Let's talk about unintended consequences in another area that's much more legal. Remember that the Ninth Circuit said that it was going to enforce the copyright claim of an actress in The Innocence of Muslims who she essentially said, they told me I was appearing in a perfectly nice film about the desert, and instead they put words in my mouth impugning Muhammad. It's going to get me killed. The YouTube video is everywhere. I want it taken down because it I have a copyright in my performance. And the Ninth Circuit, 2-1, said, yeah, we think there's some kind of copyright here that allows you to claim the right to take this down. And you can see why, at a human level, they might have thought it was a little unfair that she was taking the heat for this and could be attacked for what was essentially a scam perpetrated on her. But the law of unintended consequences, I think, is that, as Google pointed out, once you say people who appear in films or videos all have some kind of inchoate copyright claim that has to be adjudicated by looking at the nature of the agreement they had with the person who was behind the camera, the number of folks who can file takedown notices on YouTube increases by an order of magnitude. And the ability of YouTube or Google to evaluate those falls through the floor. So they made that pitch to the government, to the Ninth Circuit, and said, can't you stay this while we go to Enbank, which is clearly where they're going? The court said no, but they also said something interesting that is a kind of half measure for Google. Apparently, if her performance is blanked out of the YouTube version of the film, then it can stay up. And so that appears to be where this will be left. But I got the strong sense that in their effort to do justice to this one woman, the Ninth Circuit made a little more law than they were planning on, and they may end up regretting this. The Enbank panel may, assuming it goes to the Enbank, which I suspect it will, may come out in a different place.
Yeah, I had the same reaction as I was reading the opinion, that it was clear that Judge Kaczynski and the panel were trying to do right by this woman, and it's admirable because she, by any measure, got scammed, and, you know, with horrible, horrible consequences and potentially life-threatening consequences. But even during the opinion, there are references to the fact that there might be more at stake here than just this one woman's situation. And Judge Kaczynski says that leaves open the question of the right of other actors or other performers or contributors to a movie to copyright, have a copyright interest in their performance. I think it's clear that an effort to do right by her is potentially going to create some serious implications, not just for Google and other providers, but for the law of copyright.
Yeah. So it's going to be, I would say it's going to be fun to watch, but it's actually, it would be kind of painful for those who would like to see, free and open exchange of information on the internet. Okay. So one more, surprising, legal consequence, in this area is, Sprint case. The U.S. government has sued Sprint for millions of dollars, claiming that it overcharged for wiretaps, in violation of an FCC ruling about what is an appropriate charge. This is an outgrowth, if I remember, of some claims by whistleblowers saying we want to bring this lawsuit, which were mostly dismissed. Now it appears that at least as to this one carrier, the government is going to be pursuing it. You oversaw all these, a lot of wiretaps in your position in government. Is this a surprise? What's the government's goal here? What tools are they using?
When I was in AUSA, we used to, the law enforcement agencies used to complain all the time about the cost of a wiretap. That, you know, under the Wiretap Act and under the Pen Register statute, the government is required to reimburse providers, or providers are allowed to seek reimbursement for reasonable expenses incurred in providing the facilities and technical assistance necessary to make the court, to carry out the court order for the wiretap or the Pen Register. And I should say, since we started talking about Snowden every week, that this, we're talking here about court-authorized wiretaps that a criminal, in a criminal case, or court-authorized Pen Registers. And I can't recall a situation when I was a prosecutor or when I was a Maine justice in which law enforcement agencies didn't complain about the cost of those wiretaps. That, you know, one of the biggest budget items in the Justice Department in the law enforcement agency's budgets is the cost of wiretaps and other electronic surveillance. And it's based on claims that the providers submit for being able to help the government carry those out.
When I was representing, carriers, I used to try to persuade people like the EFF and the ACLU that this was one of the principal practical protections for civil liberties, because it made it a very expensive decision that had to go to high levels before you actually carried out a wiretap. They always wanted to win some big symbolic victory. They were not comfortable with this one, maybe because they figured the more money companies made off of this, the more cooperative they would be. Hmm.
Well, you know, I think your view on that is right. I mean, you know, as a legal matter, before you can go get a wiretap, you've got to demonstrate as a matter of law that it's necessary. That is, that you've exhausted all other less intrusive investigative techniques. As a practical matter, though, that's true as well, because you've got to justify to the agency that you need another phone, or that you need to expand the scope of your wiretap to another target, or do a wiretap in the first place, and that it's something you need to accomplish the goals of your investigation, because the agency's got to pay for it, and they got to pay a lot. Now, according to the U.S. government in this case, they were paying too much, about $21 million too much, because according to the government, which is sued under the False Claims Act, they say that over 29,000 times between the beginning of 2007 and the middle of 2010, Sprint submitted claims that were inflated. And they say they were inflated because they included the cost of upgrading Sprint systems to accommodate wiretaps and to accommodate the government's need to conduct court-authorized electronic surveillance. Under the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, carriers were required to upgrade their systems and their facilities to enable the execution of wiretap orders and Pen Register orders. But the FCC said in 2006 that the carriers were prohibited from passing those costs on to the law enforcement agencies. There is a mechanism under CLIA to petition the Attorney General for reimbursement of those upgrading investments in upgrading their systems. And there's a budget that Congress has set aside for the AG to pay those, to reimburse those costs. But the FCC says you cannot pass those costs on to the agencies in the form of wiretap expenses.
I have a question. Maybe you don't know the answer, but who the hell is the FCC to be making that decision? This is a statute that is enforced by the courts, right? You can go to the court and say, I want to get paid my expenses. Wouldn't this be something that Sprint and the government could reasonably be expected to be litigating in front of the judge that authorized the particular wiretap?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know why it's never been litigated in that format, and I don't know to what extent any carrier attempted to challenge the FCC's authority to interpret CLIA at the time. My understanding is that Sprint actually participated in the rulemaking process that gave rise to that,
I'm sure they
that
did,
FCC ruling. And the ruling is pretty clear that these are costs that cannot be passed on to the agencies. But the U.S. government says that that's exactly what Sprint did, and that these false claims were submitted to literally an alphabet soup of federal agencies, DEA, ATF, FBI, the Marshals, the ICE, the Secret Service, even the postal inspectors and the IRS. And Sprint, of course, vigorously denies the allegations, says that they only submitted expenses that were reasonable and that they're authorized under statute to submit. But if Sprint's wrong and the government's right, it could be really quite costly. Treble damages is what the government's seeking, which would be north of $60 million.
I thought that was interesting. That's presumably False Claims Act liability, yeah, which I think of as something that arises in the context of contract claims, right? You have a contract and you bill too much under the contract. You pad your hours or your expenses. There's not necessarily a contract here that says you will provide wiretapping services for us. They send a bill, and say this is what you owe us. Maybe that's understandable under the False Claims Act, which, as I remember, goes way back to like the Civil War. And I'm sure that people were just sending in invoices during the Civil War for
sure,
things that happened to them. I suspect that, when they decided to push the envelope, if they did, Sprint never considered the possibility that they would be held trebly liable for what they've asked for.
You know, I suspect that's right. And as you said, there's not a contract between law enforcement agency and Sprint, at least not a written contract. In fact, there's a court order, and the court order actually directs the provider to provide the assistance and authorizes the provider to seek reimbursement. So this is all in the execution of an order by a court. But the False Claims Act is going to be powerful, not just because of the treble damages, but there are civil penalties too, from $5,500 to $11,000 per false claim. And as I mentioned a moment ago, the government says there were over 29,000 false claims. So the civil penalties alone could be really quite a big ticket for Sprint.
Well, knowing the Justice Department, Sprint's probably lucky that they didn't say, oh, and every one of those is a violation of 18 U.S.C. 1001. you know, so it's a question of how much criminal liability
right,
we're going to impose. All right, well, this will be worth watching. Cybersecurity, everybody seems to have taken the U.S. as a model for pursuing cybersecurity. There's a story today talking about China creating a national coordination body for cybersecurity so that China can become a great power in cyberspace. The European Union has said that it wants a cybersecurity directive, and it is urging stakeholders to support that proposition. This is a kind of general rule that I've observed, that the U.S. often pioneers government policies and then watches as other parts of the world that are more enthusiastic about government regulation adopt that and surpass it. Both China and Europe are much more regulatory regimes than the United States has. So I think we can expect that, as I once said, Europe and now China lives the bureaucratic dreams of American bureaucrats. Before we turn to Mark, I think we ought to also cover this week in FTC law, because as always, the FTC is making new rules and getting away with it. What's been happening in the last week or so on that?
We previously reported, I think, in an earlier episode, on a case that the FTC brought against a company called TrendNet, which is a maker of video equipment that allows customers to view their home security systems or their baby monitors remotely using software and mobile apps. And this is a timely story for anyone who complained this weekend that their coffee makers and microwaves and other devices in their house don't change their clocks to account for daylight savings time. TrendNet marketed the product as secure. In fact, the name of the product, I think, is Secure View. And the FTC says it was anything but, that not only were the login credentials by customers submitted in the clear, but they said that the live video feed being sent by the cameras to the remote user were also accessible to anybody. And in fact, in 2012, some hackers got in, intercepted the video feed and posted it online, posting feeds from some, like, 700 cameras showing people's babies sleeping and children playing and adults going about their lives.
And oh, talk about going straight to the heart for new parents, especially.
This would
drive you crazy to discover this.
Oh, absolutely. And people reacted accordingly, and the FTC went after the company for both deceptive trade practices, that is misleading consumers that the product was secure, and unfair trade practices, saying that the failure to secure the cameras caused injury to consumers. And now TrendNet has settled. I think it's around the 51st data security or privacy settlement for the FTC overall, but it's the first involving the Internet of Things. And the settlement requires, as usual, implementation of a comprehensive data security program and third-party audits. The FTC continues to be the Full Employment Act for people who conduct security assessments. And for companies that are pursuing opportunities presented by the Internet of Things, it's a real cautionary tale that you gotta build security into your product from the beginning. And certainly aim a little higher than this company did.
So I can't help observing what a case of ADD the FTC has. I mean, they're still arguing with LabMD over whether LabMD was engaged in an unfair trade practice for allowing one of its employees to use a file sharing program that provided access to free music, which, you know, the world, the cyber world has moved on from that for a decade, and the idea that the FTC is standing firm protecting us against people who are sloppy with LimeWire is nuts. Nobody cares anymore. And so they're herring off after this latest Internet of Things security problem. And the other observation is I used to accuse the European data protection authorities of basically only enforcing the law against people who ended up in the newspaper. But it sure feels like that's what's going on here. You know, LabMD ended up being excoriated by somebody in testimony to Congress, and the FTC came down on them like a ton of bricks. These guys end up in the papers because of a decision from the hackers to publicize what they'd done. It's almost as though this is a law that only applies to people who end up in the newspaper.
Well, you can see why. You know, we've talked before about the fact that, you know, companies get breached and they report their breaches to state regulators or to the FTC, and the reward is that they get investigated or they get sued. I mean, one of the things that in fairness to the FTC, which is, by the way, a phrase you, in our time together, you have never heard me say, a lot of the companies that they go after are low-hanging fruit for the FTC,
right?
You know, a case like this. So however the FTC discovered it, it had a lot of things, as you alluded to, that make it a very appealing case for them to pursue. But it does, as you said, point out the larger issue that companies' rewards for they're either self-reporting a problem or having a problem become public is that they have an investigation waiting for them. The FTC's approach to developing cybersecurity laws to say, you know, sort of we know reasonable when we see it, or at least we know unreasonable when we see it. Good luck figuring out what reasonable is. Unfortunately, for companies that are really trying to do it right, the FTC is only going after companies that clearly do it wrong. And it doesn't really give any guidance to companies that don't do things like this, but that, like TrendNet did, but that are generally struggling with the question of what's reasonable.
Yeah, it is fascinating. It suggests that the best way to stay out of trouble with the FTC is to have your breach third, not first. If I were at the FTC, this is what I'd be doing too, because one, you're more likely to get your preferred order from somebody who's, you know, already flat on his back from bad publicity, and you know, the IRS is most aggressive about pursuing criminal sanctions against people that are famous because it ends up in the paper and everybody reads that and says, wow, you know, I did that too. Maybe I'll stop because they may come for me. And of course, the IRS can't come after everybody who fiddles on their taxes. So they prefer to go after the people who are likely to make the most news. So it's a perfectly rational policy. But if you're on the receiving end of it, it certainly feels like piling on, if nothing else. Yes. Yeah. All right. Well, I've got one more topic I just wanted to talk about foreign jurisdictions that are imitating the U.S. Mark Weatherford points out that California is also imitating the U.S., setting up its own cybersecurity commission or at least proposing to. I don't know whether the bill to do this actually is has gone anywhere. Mark, what do you know about this proposal?
Well, all I know, a couple of my friends in California sent me this. It is was introduced by John Perez, and I think it's a recognition. You know, California oftentimes leads the way, sometimes infamously, and sometimes not. Certainly, you know, SB 1386 was the first data breach law at the state level. So this, I think, may be a recognition from the legislature in California that there is more at stake here than just bad publicity. You know, I view this as an economic issue in many respects, and states can actually, can do a lot by putting the protocols and frameworks around security for the state government. Now, this is a little different, though. I think they're bringing private sector people onto this commission, which are going to advise technology department in the state of California. So I don't quite know how that's going to work, and it looks like the CISO in California, which I used to be, is going to be part of this, but also report into this commission. So, more to come. I think and it's just been introduced on February 20th. So, I think there's going to be some interesting
on the whole. Given you know, it's more help for government bureaucrats, and they usually say that in a tone that suggests that they could live without the help. What's your sense? Is this going to be a good development or a bad one?
I think as long as they don't try to the commission does not try to legislate, if they try to inform, it will probably be a good thing.
And then we'll see other states do the same, huh?
Probably.
Yeah. All right. Well, so maybe this is a good sign that the California is going to take this seriously as something other than just exposure of people's social security numbers, maybe exposure of other much more important information, and try to do something about it. Lord knows they've got plenty of experts they can get advice from.
As long as they don't overreach.
Right.
You know, government is very good at overreaching, and there's always unintended consequences for too much of that.
So I think that ought to wrap up our news roundup, and we've already started, frankly, on the interview with our guest. Mark Weatherford had a distinguished career before he came to DHS, including time at NERC, if I remember, and California CISO. But he went to DHS to really head up the cybersecurity effort and finished up that work after about, a year and a half? And has since gone on to the Chertoff Group. Mark, maybe we could start with where you thought DHS was when you first arrived on the job, what had actually been done, and I will start by saying I was there for a while before you got there, and I knew there was plenty that we weren't doing that we needed to do, and it's been an upward trend. But what did you think were the biggest things the department should have been doing that they weren't doing?
Well, the cybersecurity program at DHS has been around for a number of years, and certainly U.S. CERT is maybe one of the most well-recognized security organizations in the world. There's been a lot of evolution over the past couple of years. The budget's grown a tremendous amount. The number of people working there has exploded, both the government employees and the contractors.
Do you know what the mix is between government employees and contractors?
Yeah, I think it's about 3-1. Three contractors to every one government.
Wow, that's not sustainable.
It's not. It's expensive to do it that way. It's hard, you know, this gets back into the talent issue. It's hard to find the right kind of people with the right kind of talent.
Yes.
To come and work in the federal government. And quite frankly, that was one of the things that I tried to work on. I had a modicum of success, but that was breaking through the barriers in HR to bring people on board. And they're still struggling with that. It still takes far, far, far too long.
When I was out at RSA, I met a guy who is a Coast Guard reservist and the chief information security officer of a company, big company. And I said, oh, that's great because, you know, the Coast Guard's part of DHS and you can provide security advice to the government. And he said, actually, the Coast Guard has never given me a job that uses my information security capabilities. I've already sent his name on to NPPD to say you really should talk to the Coast Guard about finding a way to make sure that your cybersecurity experts, who are also reservists, get to do their reserve duty in ways that make the country safer from cyber attacks.
Well, that I would say, you know, that's replicated across the other four military services as well. There are people that have jobs in technology and jobs in security in their private sector lives, but their jobs in the military and their reserve duties are wildly different than
that's,
that.
That's nuts.
They're trying to marry them up a little bit more. I mean, there's certainly it's an order of magnitude better than it was a decade ago, but it's still a challenge in the military for that. And DHS struggles with that, I think, you know, because of that. You know, we had, Secretary Napolitano sponsored an initiative 2 years ago to actually look at the talent issue at DHS, figure out how we could bring more people in, how we could bring more people in more quickly, how we could train the people.
Didn't you get more legislative authority to hire people outside of the usual process?
Actually, we found that we already had the authority, but it still is a struggle. For an organization that's only 10 years old, they have a lot of archaic practices.
I remember we started an honors program for DHS.
Yeah.
And, you know, the president, without the slightest notice, just ended it. But when he ended all of the non-standard hiring processes, it's been sort of reinvented at DHS. But I always thought that was some government union special pleading said, well, they're not hiring people in ways that we like, and he just kind of cut off everything.
Well, actually, so Secretary Napolitano still had that program. Now, I don't know if that's the same one.
It's the revival.
Okay. So, and she, and that was actually one of the things that, you know, that we worked on fairly hard, to keep that going. But again, it's, you know, there's resources that go into managing the program. There's costs that go into recruiting and maintaining the people. I would say if there's one really issue that that DHS could get better at, it is the HR practices around recruiting, hiring, and retaining good people. It really is a challenge.
It does seem to me that part of the problem that DHS had in the early years is if you want somebody who's high energy and high talent, you got to give them something that requires high energy and high talent. And when we were just inviting people in for coffee and cookies and a discussion of the problem on the advisory committees, you didn't need a lot of energy and talent to do that. And so one of the questions is, what jobs are we giving these people? And one of the successes that I think you had was in actually persuading the government to, the federal government as a whole, to say, here are really hard problems, DHS is in charge of them, and to then turn to DHS and say, you better hire somebody to do this because you cannot fail.
Yeah, and so I think between the DHS people that we had working on this and some of the contractors that we had, you know, we were able to go to some of the contractors that we had, and request, you know, very specific talent that they were able to go out and hire, which is actually, you know, gives the government a lot of flexibility. You know, you can ebb and flow with the talent as you need it that way. One of the other things that, and I talked with Secretary Napolitano when I interviewed for the job, and I said, you know, one of the things that I would like to do, if, you know, should I be chosen for this, is move some of this work, DHS work, out of the DC metro area. I would say, well, for all intents and purposes, 100% of the DHS talent is right here in DC. Well, you know, there's a lot of people scattered around the country that don't want to move but are very talented that could support what DHS is doing. So one of the things that we did, we opened a facility down in Pensacola, Florida, on the Navy base there, and we're going to end up having a couple of hundred people, I think, at some point in that facility. We started an office out in the Bay Area.
Right.
And my goal was to have...
I hope not within 20 miles of 101, because you can't afford it and they can't afford to live there.
He wanted to go. It was a marriage made in heaven. He wanted to go and I wanted somebody to go out there, and so it worked out for us. But, you know, but there's a lot of interest for people that want to work for the government. They want to do, as you said, exciting things for the government. They just don't want to work in Washington DC.
Yeah.
And many of them don't want to move. So, you know, to the extent that we could, if it was unclassified work, you know, we could push that work out to people and let them do it from wherever they are, quite frankly.
Yeah. Although I have to say, I don't think it was an accident that Snowden succeeded, 8,000 miles from Washington, D.C.
You don't think so.
Things get a lot more informal out there, and it's harder to supervise. So I think it makes sense to do this, but there are some real risks in it, too.
Well, and that goes, I think, to another one of the big issues with the government in general, and that is we overclassify things far, far too much. You know, the same kinds of problems and issues that the private sector deals with every single day, the government deals with, but puts a classified sticker on them. And so, so you alienate, the people that could be helping you, because many of them, quite frankly, don't want to have a clearance. They don't want to go through the process of having a clearance. So I think this overclassification of information, you know, you mentioned Snowden, absolutely, you could not be more correct there. You know, the further away you are from the mothership, the more opportunities I think you have, to engage in things that he did. And I would just say, there's a bit of irony right now that, Snowden is speaking this very second in South by Southwest.
Yes, I was hoping I'd have a chance to hear that before that we started, but we didn't get to do
that. I'm sure it'll be better on tape delay.
Well, you know, the last time he spoke was to the Oxford Union, the streets of Kiev were awash in blood, and there was mass surveillance all over the place, and he gave a impassioned talk on the evils of overclassification. It said not a thing about Snowden, about Kiev. I've tried to popularize the hashtag pound Snowden stand silent, because he has stood silent on Kiev, on the Sochi surveillance, on the Crimea invasion. Maybe he's supposed to be taking questions from the audience. We'll see whether either his interlocutor or the audience is allowed to ask him a question about some of that, which you'd think he would have some views on.
Well, he's in a tough situation. He's got nowhere to go.
He put himself there. I'm sorry. My sympathy's limited. Okay. So in terms of what you did, I at least have a sense, as you kind of hinted, that DHS took on some big roles, information sharing about and actual intrusion monitoring and in some cases prevention for the entire civilian arm of the federal government, roles under the executive order to incentivize people to adopt the framework. Which of those things do you think are really working well now?
Well, when I arrived, I had many, many priorities, but we kind of decided on three main priorities, and one of them was the Einstein program, that we had to advance the Einstein program.
And the Einstein program was one that essentially it was an intrusion detection system, moving toward intrusion prevention.
Absolutely. And so where we were moving is to take that and take the signatures and countermeasures that the government was developing, the classified signatures and countermeasures, and provide those back out to, private sector ISPs. So the technology to do that was the hurdles that we had to overcome. But one of the other priorities, as given to me by the leadership at DHS was to heal the relationship with NSA.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing that I wasn't aware of before I got there when I arrived. I found that the relationship wasn't that bad. Some of the people down at the technical level that had fundamental disagreements on technical approaches to things. But, you know, I spent a lot of time with General Alexander and with Chris Inglis. And for the most part, we agreed on almost everything. I thought that was, I think one of the successes that I had when I left is I felt very good about where the relationship between DHS and NSA and, quite frankly, the FBI as well.
So it seemed to me that, frankly, at least, neither DHS or NSA can afford to have a bad relationship. At least in Snowden, no one is going to ask NSA to secure the civilian infrastructure comfortably, and no one at DHS is capable of doing it without getting a lot of help from NSA. So it seems logical that they would have to work together, but that there would necessarily be strains as a result.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, the DIB pilot had, the Defense Industrial Base pilot had just wrapped up just before I arrived, and it exposed some of the weaknesses, I think, in the relationships between DHS and NSA and the private sector.
So the DIB pilot is essentially an exercise where you use a lot of the classified information that NSA and DOD had to try to inform and protect, the case of the DIB pilot, mainly defense contractors.
Right.
So that, and I think always think of it as sort of a, there's a black box full of all this classified signature information, mm-hmm. and it sits in the intrusion detection and prevention system, and incoming attachments are bounced off of it to see if they match, and no one knows exactly what's in the black box, but it provides some protection for whoever is on the other side of that that box.
That's absolutely right, and as a matter of fact, I think we proved over the last couple of years that, you know, that there was some value in that program. As a matter of fact, when part of the executive order the president signed last February, part of the executive order was for DHS to expand that program back to out to more broader to private sector. It's called the Enhanced Cybersecurity Program.
Ah, yeah.
So take the same kind of information, and after, you know, a vetting process and, you know, developing relationships with private companies to begin sharing that same kind of information.
And how is DHS doing in making that sale and actually administering that?
So I don't know. You know, I've been gone for about 10 months now. But it sounds, I have had a few conversations with people that are, they're talking about it. And as you can imagine, this is not a trivial issue to take sensitive information and give it to, you know, a company who probably no one in the company's ever had a security clearance before.
Right.
But I think, you know, I'm going to step a little bit back into the, and I know you have some thoughts on this as well, the NIST cybersecurity framework.
Right.
You know, I think many of us had low expectations, if that's not overstating it, for what the NIST framework would actually accomplish. But I have to say I'm pleasantly surprised. And I've been an advocate for it in some respects. I spent the week out at RSA in San Francisco too. And it was probably, aside from Snowden, it was probably the number one issue that I heard people talking about as related to the government.
Yeah.
And
we had Adam Sedgwick on last week. I think the general view is they got a tough assignment, and they did about as well with that tough assignment as you could have.
It's hard to be, you know, you may be critical of the content, but you can't be critical of the process and the work that people put into it. You know, both NIST and DHS, they really, really did a lot of work, you know, and you got to give them a lot of credit for getting to where they did.
So let me ask what I think is the tough question about this, which is, NIST did a good job basically by saying, we want to do what the private sector, we want to say what the private sector wants us to say. But DHS is now going to have to find a way to turn that into something that the regulatory agencies can use in the context where they're not doing what the private sector wants, but they're trying to goose people into doing a little bit more. How do you see that playing out?
Well, so two things. First is the nature of government. Whoever worked in the government will understand this. It's you oftentimes get more tasking and more responsibility, but you don't get more resources to do that. Just like the developing the framework, you know, there are no resources that came with that, but there were hundreds of people out of the federal government that worked on that worked literally thousands of man hours over the past year to do that. So I think that's going to be a challenge for DHS to devote the resources to this, especially in the fiscal framework that we're in. You know, most of DHS is very unusual, at least from my perspective, from a budgeting standpoint, because everybody at DHS is, or everybody within the CS&C organization is assigned to it's funded for a specific project or a specific initiative. And there is somebody on Capitol Hill that is responsible for that. So as you move people around, and that means you're taking resources from somebody's project to go do something else. And, just a little anecdote. One of my other priorities, one of my top three priorities when I got to DHS was to reorganize and simplify the organization. And and I could see very clearly how to do that. But as I started talking about moving people around, the antibodies, came out of the woodwork
Well, that was your mistake. You never talk about it. You just do it. You just
They
come in on Monday and you say, oh, you have a new job. That's the only way it's going to work.
Yeah, that's true. But to go back to that, I think, you know, the regulatory agencies, most regulatory agencies, quite frankly, I think many of them have the authority already to implement the kind of regulatory structure around security.
Sure, if you listen to the FTC, it would say there is no limit to our regulatory authority, and we've got court decisions to prove it.
But I would, I came from NERC, as you mentioned. The FERC has broad authority over the electricity industry in North America. As a matter of fact, the acting commissioner issued a press release on Friday saying that they were going to direct NERC to begin developing physical security standards. This is in response to the Metcalf incident in the Bay Area last year where the
Where they shot out the transformers. Yes.
So I think we've suspected that for a while that that there was going to be some action on that. But so I think you know the, and I've said this publicly, so I'm not embarrassed to say this any longer. But if the NIST framework does nothing more than get people talking about security in the private sector across the nation, then it's been successful in my mind.
Mm-hmm. And it's clearly going to do that.
Yes.
So people are thinking about how they can comply, and, yep. and really, frankly, when you look at the standard, the framework, it is just an elaborate agenda for talking. There is nothing in particular that you have to do. You just have to think about a bunch of things.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, it does take the best pieces of, I think, five different existing standards and provides them as a framework for people to select from. So
let me ask, is there something that's happened since you left that you think is particularly worth noting? You know, 10 months seems like a long time, but my bet is that they're still implementing things that you were hoping to do when you were there. I had a boss once who was a military guy who said, you know, it's amazing. I meet my colleagues in my general class, and they are all, almost without exception, smart, engaging, can-do people. It's just that they're... The only idiots seem to be the people that I replace and the people who replace me. And so this is your opportunity to indulge that sentiment as well. What do you think that has happened, good and bad, since you left?
Well, so good. I think Phyllis Schneck is probably the best person they could have picked for the job.
Yeah, she's great.
You know, I mean, it does require a unique mix of skills to do that job, both public sector and private sector. And, you know, we talked to and interviewed 30 or 40 people. And, you know, everybody had some unique qualities, but no one had the entire package that Phyllis does. So I'm very optimistic, you know, that she's going to pull things together there.
The one gap she has, she hadn't been that close to actually doing things in the federal government, which means that she's going to be rudely surprised.
I did warn her about that.
Yes.
I know that there's a bit of embedded inertia in the federal government that, try as you might, you just have to learn to live with that or work around it as
right.
best you can.
On the other hand, this is really like crossing no man's land and all the barbed wire. You just need a whole bunch of people to throw their body on the barbed wire so the next person can step over it and throw their body on another piece of barbed wire. So hopefully she's found new barbed wire to throw her body on.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I'm hearing little pieces of success coming out of there. So I'm very hopeful. You know, even if when you're gone, you always want, you know, the organization to do well. So, so I think back to your question, one of the things I think that we struggled with a little bit, and it was a political to some degree, and that is DHS is the Department of Homeland Security, and their responsibilities are to work with all of the critical infrastructure sectors in the nation. And because of the way the structure of the U.S. government, there are various agencies that have the overall responsibility for some of these sectors, but tying all that together, knitting all of from an information sharing perspective together is DHS's responsibility. And, you know, no one likes it when somebody in the room says, I'm responsible, that's my job. But DHS has to do that because they are, in fact, responsible, and it is their job. One of the other things that, you know, that as I left, I really wish I would have spent more time on and perhaps been a little bit more successful at is, the Information Sharing and Analysis Center concept was established in PDD 63, I think, in 1998 by President Clinton. And there wasn't a lot of guidance around it. It just said, go out and establish these information sharing and analysis centers around these 18 critical infrastructures at the time. And so today, these ISACs are, there's no consistency in any of them. They're governed differently. They're governed by different people. Some of them are embedded within the sector itself. Some of them are nonprofits outside the sector. And because of that, it's very difficult to share information across the sectors. There is even a National Council of Information, of ISACs, which tries to do that. The DHS provides a little bit of funding to one or two of those ISACs. And what I wish I could have done, and I just didn't focus on, didn't put enough brain cells against it, was to take a little bit of our budget and sprinkle across all the ISACs so they could mature them all a little bit, float all of them a little bit higher. And I think that's something that is going to happen over time. To me, it's one of the things that really would help evenly, equitably, across all of the 16 critical infrastructures. If the government was able to provide funding without trying to direct how that funding was spent.
Right. Just a little bit of staffing, yeah. and some consistency. Yeah. Although my sense is the framework actually puts a fairly high premium on information sharing. And so one of the questions for some of these less active ISACs and industries will be, how much information sharing were you really doing if you participated in an ISAC that consisted of people getting together every 3 months to complain about the federal government?
Right.
If that's all you're doing, maybe you're not really sharing information. So my guess is that there'll be a little bit more consistency over time. And part of it is security is just more or less important to some of these guys because of the economics of it. So let me close this up by asking what you're doing now at the Chertoff Group and how you're liking it.
Well, I love it. Now when people call me and ask for me to help me, they actually want me to come and help
them. Yeah, because they're paying for it.
Because they're paying for it. So
that's what I find, too. I know they want me in the meeting because it's costing them a boatload to have me in the meeting.
That's right.
As opposed to in government where you know you're in the meeting because they had to let
you
in.
They had to let us in. That's right. And we're a security consulting firm, and I am working with companies literally across the globe. Kind of to address the problem you mentioned a second ago, there's a lot of these CEOs and boards that really don't understand cybersecurity. It's a hard thing to understand. But they know they need to be because it's in the paper every day, you know, and their colleagues are calling them and their lawyers are calling them saying, have we done the right due diligence? So we're getting more, we're able to get in and, you know, where I used to talk to chief information security officers or chief security officers, I'm finding that now, you know, it's more CEOs and board members that are calling me to ask me questions, which quite frankly is actually more helpful because they're the ones that, that can drive the resources, that the CISO, in fact, gets to take advantage of. In fact, an interesting story, we did an engagement last year and, toward the end of the year, the CISO called us and says, hey, I just want you guys to know, because of the work that we did with you, my CEO just gave me $10 million to build out our, you know, to enhance our cybersecurity program. I can tell you.
That's a return on investment.
As a three-time CISO, you know, that's the kind of phone calls you want to get.
So I listened to, Mike McConnell give a speech at RSA where he said something kind of remarkable, he said, you know, there's only a couple of things I want you to remember from this talk, but here's one of them. At Booz Allen, the CIO reports to the CISO. They've completely flipped their usual reporting relationship. But that's a reflection that they don't want information technology that diminishes their security, is a statement of priorities that I think other companies may start making.
Well, you know, I mean, 10 years ago, most companies didn't have a CISO. And now no company would, there's still a few, but most companies, have a CISO, and we're seeing, you know, there's an evolution occurring here, where I think, you know, security is certainly as important as building out an efficient infrastructure, or it's certainly a part of building out an efficient infrastructure. So, you know, maybe we'll start seeing more CIOs working for CISOs.
Well, on that hopeful note, I want to thank Mark Weatherford and Jason Weinstein for participating in today's podcast. This has been episode 10 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. We hope you'll join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. And for more information, please visit our website at www.steptocyberblog.com. Thank you.